So good afternoon to those of you in the zone, and good evening to others of you, and good day to others. One of the things we hear Dharma teachers say again and again is to keep it simple, to keep the practice simple. Just to be aware of what's there. But when we look at the mind, often it seems like anything but simple. We've got all these body sensations, emotions, thoughts, hindrances, all vying for our attention. This teaching on clear comprehension isn't meant to be a list of additional things to do, to remember to do. But it points at the things we already do a lot of the time, both in daily life and formal practice. We regularly have purposes, and we regularly figure out what's needed to accomplish them and engage in the process of accomplishing them. And then we can see the results. We either learn from it or we appreciate it. For instance, in meditation, we may have the purpose to relax the body. We might consider the suitability of scanning the body and relaxing it part by part. And then we actually engage in the process. And that's the posture of the body. Maybe relaxing the forehead, the jaw, and so on. And then when we finish scanning, we can see clearly the reality that the body is more relaxed and maybe appreciate the less tension. So today I'm going to talk about the third of the four kinds of clear comprehension. Clear comprehension of posture of practice. The word for posture is gachara, the Pali word is gachara. It means where cattle go and graze. It can be seen as the place where we get nourished. The word's also sometimes you hear it translated as the domain of practice, the field of practice. We can think of it as a large pasture with a rocky mountain to the right and a muddy marsh to the other side. The cattle only get nourished if they stay on the pasture. If they stray into the rocky area, they might get caught by the uneven ground and there's no food to be found. If they stray in the muddy marsh, there's no food there. So the only place that nourishes them is the pasture. In the same way, if we're making lunch, the kitchen is the pasture where we make lunch. It's definitely not our smartphone. So we stay in our pasture. When we practice, that's where we get nourished. The human mind can think of an infinite number of interesting things, and just as many not interesting ones. I trust you have all spent plenty of time discovering both of those. In practice, we learn that giving attention to some things nourishes us, and giving attention to other things might deplete us instead. I spend time thinking about the practice and the choice of the practice, or even about a good friend I love, it nourishes me. If I think about how inadequate I am, or how much I mess something up, or that depletes us. (Clears throat) And most of us don't have much doubt that mental activity, such as needlessly spending time anxiously worrying or anxiously planning, how those tend to deplete us, how those don't benefit us. And they don't just deplete us in the moment, but it also strengthens the mental tendency to worry and be anxious in the future. And as we've mentioned, if we spend a lot of time fantasizing, we get much better at it. If we complain a lot, we're practicing complaining. We can become complaining experts. But we can also see that being mindful of our experience with a kind curiosity, it can nourish us quite deeply. And that the more often we're mindful this way, the easier it is to be mindful in the future. It can become our default way of being. The Buddha taught that our spiritual nourishment can be found in the pasture of the four foundations of mindfulness. This is where the practice does its work. The pasture of practice is the place where we practice so that mindfulness can develop to bring us to freedom. Establishing mindfulness includes not just connecting to the present moment, but also seeing it clearly and thoroughly. In a simple way, clear comprehension of pasture is seeing what supports our path and what takes us away from the path, what nourishes us and what doesn't. In meditation, when we wander outside of the pasture of the four foundations, it depletes our energy. And we need this energy for deepening our practice, for freeing ourselves. These four foundations of mindfulness can build on each other. Each one supports the next. The Satipatthana Sutta asks us to observe, putting aside greed and distress for the world, one observes the body in itself. One observes feeling tones in themselves. One observes the mind in itself. One observes the dhammas in themselves. That's keeping it simple, observing the body in itself, just as it is, and the same with the other foundations. These four foundations begin with mindfulness of the body. The body's here, now. Everything we feel and experience is expressed through the body. How we relate to our body affects what we feel and experience. We can be in the pasture of this body. We can be nourished by this body. When we engage intimately with the breath, with the body, we can see clearly when we're adding unnecessary tensions. The sutta points us to notice the quality of the breath, not to judge it or evaluate it, keeping it simple, just noticing what's there. Breathing in long, I know I am breathing in long. Simple recognizing. Breathing in short, I know I am breathing in short. But the breath, in turn, can affect the body. You don't need to force anything, just incline the mind towards calm. This sutta continues with, breathing in, I experience the whole body. Breathing out, I experience the whole body. Breathing in, I calm the bodily formation. Breathing out, I calm the bodily formation. As mindfulness of the body develops, we become centered in our bodies. It brings stability of strength. I connect with the phrase to stand on our own 2 feet in this body. It's a way of implying that we're capable, we can trust ourselves. Mindfulness of the body can be a very rich pasture for practice. As we continue to settle in the body and our thoughts slow down, we get quieter and quieter, and we're able to see our experience more clearly. And so the second foundation, mindfulness of feeling tone, can naturally come into focus. Feeling tone refers to the fact that things are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Though it seems obvious, it's an amazingly powerful force in us. We're wired to seek comfort and avoid discomfort. We automatically tend to move towards pleasant, away from the unpleasant. And when we're not aware of it, this natural movement towards comfort, away from discomfort, can quickly develop and strengthen into the clinging of greed and aversion. I'll give a kind of a small example from my early practice. I went for a walk one day, which I normally love doing. And it was like a particularly beautiful summer day, late afternoon. The color in the sky was just gorgeous. And I found myself surprisingly impatient to get home. And I just wasn't enjoying myself. And it took me a while to notice that one of my socks had a big hole in the ball of the foot. And it wasn't painful. It was just a little uncomfortable. And not seeing it, I just kept wanting to avoid it. And I went to get home to get rid of it. And but once I saw it, I was able to come back to the present and let it go and enjoy the rest of the walk. But these things, these forces of seeking comfort can be so underneath so much of what we do. Seeking pleasant, avoiding unpleasant. The Satipatthana Sutta describes 2 categories of feeling tone, what is called feelings of the flesh and feelings not of the flesh. It's also translated as worldly and unworldly feelings. Feelings of the flesh refers to what we feel through our primary senses, seeing, hearing, touch, smell, taste, such as feeling a pleasant breeze on our skin or an unpleasant heat or tasting something sweet or something bitter or hearing pleasant music or unpleasant noise. Feelings not of the flesh can refer to the pleasant and unpleasant feelings that arise in our inner life through meditation. The pleasant feelings that can arise, such as tranquility or happiness, or the unpleasant feelings that arise when, for instance, when we realize the painfulness of our attachments. or when we remember something we've done that was unskillful. Thoughts themselves can be pleasant or unpleasant. Emotions can be pleasant or unpleasant. Even the hindrances can be pleasant at times. Such as dreaminess of sloth and torpor sometimes can be really pleasant. Other times, not so much so. But at times, it's very seductive. A creative attack can be quite joyful. And what's interesting is that we can have both. We can have an unpleasant external feeling, such as physical pain, with an internal pleasant feeling. For instance, when the mind gets really quiet, we might have noticed some physical pain, but it's within an internal feeling of really being at peace, of being relaxed, being happy. But it doesn't really matter if it's sensual feelings or meditative feelings. The practice is the same, to be mindful of what's there, not to judge it, not to fix it, not to try to keep it, just to see it arise and fade away. Simple. And as we settle on the sensations of the body, and maybe the mind is quiet enough to notice the feeling tones of our experience, the mind can continue to settle and get even quieter. And with a little bit less activity, it's natural to just expand the attention to include the quality of the mind itself. This is the background of the mind, the mood of the mind. And this is the third foundation, mindfulness of mind, citta. This is the field in which all of these sensations come and go, which all our fleeting thoughts come and go, all our emotions come and go, all our physical sensations come and go. We can step back from the details of our experience and see the larger background in which all these activities occur. And we can observe the mind just as it is. What's the quality of the mind? Is it a mind state of craving, of aversion, delusion? Or is it a state without craving, without aversion, without delusion? Is the mind collected or scattered, expanded or contracted, free or not free? And just like a loving parent whose love stays steady regardless if their child is sick, upset, angry, or if they're happy or carefree, love them just the same. We can attend to our precious mind with this loving attitude, a loving, accepting attitude, regardless of the mind state we're in. Our nourishment comes from the awareness of our mind states, just seeing them without adding anything to them. Unwholesome mind states, when we don't see them, tend to color our experience and influence us in ways that aren't helpful to us or others. I think we've all experienced waking up in a grumpy mind state, and things that normally might not irritate us can irritate us. When we can be aware of an unwholesome mind state, with an open, non-reactive attitude, it already begins to transform it. It actually brings a wholesome quality to it. We're nourishing the mind state with awareness. We're feeding the grumpy mind with the light of awareness. Being aware of the body is the pasture of practice. Being aware of feeling tones is pasture. Being aware of mind states is our pasture. Being lost in anger is not the pasture of practice. But being aware that anger has arisen is the pasture, and that awareness nourishes us. Sometimes in meditation, the mind gets settled and gives rise to creative energy. And some of us occasionally get lost in what I mentioned before, in what we affectionately call creative attacks. I've written a whole book during one, while sitting peacefully in my cushion, of course. I've always been impressed by one of the creative attacks that Gil described, where he spent, I think, quite a bit of time designing a helicopter. These are fun, you know, they're thoroughly enjoyable, these creative attacks, but they're not the pasture of practice. They can be very wholesome states in a different setting. But when we've given this time to this important path towards freedom, then during this time that we devote to meditation, to practice, we can say that's not the pasture of practice right now. I've never had a creative attack that I followed and come back after the attack and felt particularly settled. I've always felt more like, okay, I'm starting, start again. So these first three foundations develop our capacity to see things as they are and to connect with them. And as the mind gets even quieter and quieter, more and more intimate, we again can see more clearly. And the fourth foundation can come into sharper focus, mindfulness of dhammas or mindfulness of mind objects. In mindfulness of dhammas, we begin to see the relationship between things. We can see the process of how we get caught and the process of how we get free, which is primarily the five hindrances are the ways we get caught: craving, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And the seven factors of awakening are the ways we get free. I read that the Buddha once summarized the practice this way. He was asked, how can you summarize entire practice very simply? And he said, abandon the hindrances and cultivate the seven factors of awakening. These factors facilitate freedom. Let's say we just sat down to meditate. The mind's a bit busy, and we turn our attention to the breath to calm the mind, But quite soon we hear very loud music coming from next door. And before we know it, aversion arises and the mind gets lost in strategizing. The letter we're going to write our neighbor, or maybe we'll knock on their door, or maybe we should move somewhere quiet. Yeah, it's time to sell the house. And at some point, we realize we're supposed to be meditating. And if we're not clinging too much, we drop the thinking and return to the breath. But as the mind gets a little more settled, this process of getting caught by aversion, can be slow enough that we have the opportunity to see much more of the process. We might notice the unpleasantness of the loud music. We might notice we don't like it. We might clearly see ourselves contract against it, kind of clench against it. And if the mind is clear and alert enough, the clinging, just by noticing this way, can begin to release itself. As long as we don't feed it with thoughts like, that music shouldn't be there, they shouldn't be doing that, it should be different. The more we see this process with any of the hindrances as they're happening, the easier it is to let them go, to not feed them. In the beginning of a retreat, we're usually lucky if we let a hindrance go after we've had it for a while. But as things really begin to slow down, it's possible to see the hindrance slowly arise and slowly release. And even if a hindrance is present, by being aware of it this way, we are actually nourishing the wholesome qualities of the mind. We're nourishing ourselves with the hindrance in front of us. Whether we're caught or not, whether there's a hindrance present or not, by attending any moment with mindfulness and clear comprehension, the seven factors of awakening are nourished. We can see the process of how these seven factors develop and mature. We can see how each of the seven factors nourishes the others. With mindfulness and clear comprehension, we nourish the investigation, which in turn brings energy. And the energy leads to joy. And the joy develops into a wonderful tranquility, which deepens into a samadhi concentration, into a deep equanimity. Even though these four foundations build on each other, at different times, it might be more beneficial, more helpful, to give wise attention to one of them or the other. Sometimes it's wise to be with the body, sometimes the feeling tones, sometimes mind states, and at other times, seeing the process of how the mind works. The process of clinging and the process of the release of clinging. These four foundations are the pasture of practice. This is where the Dharma transforms us. It's in this body that freedom is possible. Anytime we meet clinging or resistance with awareness, there's a possibility of letting it go. Of release. It's in this mind that freedom is possible. A mind that has already experienced freedom in moments of non-clinging, moments without attachment. We've all had moments without greed, hatred, and delusion. Moments of freedom. Seeing this process helps us let it go. Whenever we let go, we can recognize the happiness of those moments of freedom, which nourishes our willingness to let go of at other times. As we continue to practice, we develop the capacity to be with the most challenging conditions with a clear mind, to trust ourselves deeply, to trust awareness. Some years back, a very good friend of mine, a longtime practitioner, was dying. She knew she had no more than a few days left. And she practiced really diligently every day, even though she was ill and she was weak. And a few days before she died, she asked me, what should she do now that she was so close? How should she practice better? What are the last things she should do, you know? And I told her that there's nothing you have to do, nothing. Trust the practice. Just trust the practice. Just show up. And I said something in her relax, and she just gave me a huge smile. The fourth foundation ends with the Four Noble Truths. Seeing dukkha as it really is. Understanding how dukkha arises. Understanding how dukkha ceases. And clearly seeing the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha. Let's take a few minutes to share in the silence.